Follow us on Twitter or Facebook at MSO News Sports. Email us at msonewsports@gmail.com. Leave a voice message anytime, 978-325-3638. Stay connected to your North Shore neighbors by simply clicking on msonewsports.com.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold, and our first guest is Cheryl Bartlett, the CEO of the ELOSA Foundation and former Massachusetts Commissioner of the Department of Mental Health. Cheryl, welcome to the
public
program.
Public health.
Public health, excuse me. I got it right in the notes, and I had it wrong on the thing. Okay, very well. I'll have to fix that. Thank you for being a guest on the show, and wanted to really start out. Tell us a little bit about your background, your bio, and then get into some of the good work that you've been doing over the years.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Josh, for having me on. I always love to have an opportunity to talk about my career because I've had a lot of opportunities to really implement some public health programs that are important for people to know about. So I started my career as a nurse. I trained at Yale New Haven Hospital and was a cardiac intensive care unit nurse there for some time and decided to take an adventurous summer off and go to Nantucket Island and be a summer nurse there. Went with a cardiology friend of mine, and we were summer nurse and summer doctor at the Nantucket Cottage Hospital, and kind of fell in love with Nantucket and never really left until 2008. I worked at the Nantucket Cottage Hospital and a wide variety of clinical nursing positions, from being the infection control nurse to running a dialysis unit, ER, ICU, OR, everything. Taught me an awful lot about being a nurse, which I think ultimately made me a pretty good commissioner of health because I saw healthcare from every kind of perspective. I ended my career there as the director of clinical services, overseeing everything from rehab, social services, home care, nursing, radiology, and moved on from the hospital when the AIDS epidemic hit and realized that we needed to have a community-type response to it. It was really a public health issue. People were, their life expectancy was quite short, and it was a really growing epidemic, and I founded the Nantucket AIDS Network to take care of people with AIDS. I became a nurse case manager, did home hospice for people, I bought a house so they could live in it and be cared for, did some Lyme disease research. From there, I moved on to be the executive director of the Community Action Committee for the Cape and Islands, where it's an anti-poverty agency addressing some of the social determinants of health. It's really, again, I think, fleshed out my public health experiences on the ground, learning about what the conditions in people's lives are that really ultimately influence their health. And so looking at educational opportunity, job and career training, and child care and transportation are some of the big issues that prevent families from being self-sufficient and economically stable. And at the same time I was there, I got very involved in homelessness and had done some part-time consulting to the Plymouth Area Coalition for the Homeless and really got to understand family homelessness and some of the public health issues around that, like domestic violence and substance abuse. And then I had the great opportunity in 2008 when John Auerbach was Commissioner of Health to go to the Massachusetts Department of Public Health as the Chronic Disease Director, and I became the Director of the Bureau of Community Health and Prevention from there, and then I became the Deputy Commissioner and the Commissioner all in about a almost seven-year time period, so left there in 2014 and went back to Cape Cod, which is where my personal roots and home roots are, and helped them to develop a regional substance abuse action plan. And now I'm at ELOSA Health here in Boston working on evidence-based medicine and developing clinical guidelines and trainings for doctors and primary care providers around the best practice to manage many chronic diseases, with a particular focus on medication management and making sure that people know the different effectiveness and safety issues and costs related to the medications that we prescribe. So that's where I am today. Do a lot of volunteer work still around the opioid epidemic, helping communities to come together and find solutions that they can implement and try to make an impact. I'm on the board of the Massachusetts Organization for Addiction and Recovery, as well as Learn to Cope, which is a peer and parent support group. And most recently joined the Massachusetts Children's Alliance, which helps children advocacy centers help our young kids who have been sexually assaulted. So that's kind of my career.
Wow.
I have a lot of different interests, and I love the work I've done over the years.
I noticed reading the website for the ELOSA Foundation, it has a unique name, and it was, and you, I have you share that with us, and a little bit about, now you're not affiliated with pharmaceuticals, you're, in fact, you're very much distant from them. You're looking, when you're looking at best practices for primary care physicians, as I understood it, you're looking at evidence-based documentation, and I know you have an affiliation with Harvard Medical School. Tell us a little bit about the origin of the name of the foundation and some of the work that you folks are doing.
Absolutely, thanks. Well, our founder, Dr. Jerry Avorn, came up with the idea of academic detailing. He's the division director for Brigham and Women's Hospital and also Harvard Medical School, Division of Pharmacoepidemiology and Pharmacoeconomics, and they do the comparative research on efficacy, safety, and cost of medications. And I think over time, they're also all practicing doctors within his division, so they bring a real-life knowledge and experience. And I think there was some recognition by them that they learned often how to prescribe medication from the pharmaceutical industry. And so this idea of academic detailing, which is what ELOSA Health does, is to put these clinical practice guidelines together to educate physicians about the cost and safety of medication, hoping to improve the quality of care, reduce sort of the overprescribing phenomena that's happening in the United States.
Okay, and the...
And so the name of ELOSA came about because we're, in essence, swimming against the tide, right? There's a lot of marketing that goes directly to consumers that never was allowed legally. When I was first a nurse, there was no direct-to-consumer marketing of medications, and now there is today, and we're a very consumer-oriented society, so we all want medication. So ELOSA stands for a fish that's swimming upstream, so in essence, we're going against what the normal tide and flow is, trying to make an impact on health outcomes and the sometimes over-prescribing of medication. So ELOSA is a genus of fish that swims upstream.
Well, that's great. And it's interesting that that's the title and that's the approach. Years ago, I had a Arnold Career Services. I was a headhunter, and I was working with a gentleman, I want to say out of New York, you know what they call a splits network, and he was looking for salespeople, pharmaceutical salespeople. And I was taken back when he said, if for the really big cities, we want women who are good-looking. And he said, if you find a guy, I don't care how good he is, he's going to get buffalo. And that's the way the pharmaceutical industry works, or worked that anyway. So the notion of swimming upstream, I get it. And I'm curious to know how receptive are physicians, primary care physicians, at the evidence-based approach to medicine and medical practices?
I think once you get through the door, it's really well received. It's sometimes getting through the door because we use the same approach as the pharmaceutical sales rep would do, which is calling you up and saying we want to talk to you and talk about managing a particular disease, diabetes, and they're very suspect. I would say the one thing is the medical community is a little bit wary about the old practices of the pharmaceutical industry. So we have to convince them that we are non-commercial, unbiased, there with evidence-based, often being paid for by a government agency that wants to improve the care in a particular area or with a particular condition. And then once they recognize that and we have a visit and they see the value of the information that we both talk to them about and leave with them, they really see this as a great service to themselves, because they say, in primary care that if a doctor were to read all of what's new and trending about all the different conditions that people come to their offices for, they have to read something like 17 journal articles in a week. And we know how busy doctors are practicing. They only have 15 minutes with a patient, and they've got a lot of administrative work to support the clinical care that they give. And so to be able to synthesize all the different randomized controlled trials into one document for them and then summarize that yet even more into simple algorithms that we can walk through to help them understand what the new research is showing about particular conditions. And so in Pennsylvania, for example, where we have a big footprint, we are really, they look forward to us. We see about 800 doctors about three times a year, and we update all of our materials every 3 years so that we are providing the latest information. So, well received. Not a lot of definitive resources that are allocated for that, and we're really trying to figure out where some of the funding could come so we could really scale this up bigger in different states and across more territory in the states we're in.
And what states are you in presently?
So right now we're doing some work in Pennsylvania, in Washington, D.C., in Tennessee. We have some work we do in Maine. We just finished up a project here in Massachusetts, and one last year in Vermont. We also have a big project with the Veterans Administration where they actually have started a national center for academic detailing, primarily to address the opioid overprescribing that they were seeing across the VA, particularly with our wounded veterans. And so now they really have a full-scale ability to do academic detailing. And that, to me, is the ideal approach, is if a system recognized how this could improve their clinical practices, their health outcomes of the patients they care for, as well as reducing or saving costs by some of the reduction in overprescribing that we have been able to track over the years. We think that that is the ideal way to do academic detailing, and what we would then do is provide them with the updated clinical content, training of their staff in this, a model of education, and then helping them to monitor their improvements.
The traditional approach in terms of medicine for primary care physicians would be to read the journal articles and so forth, as you said, up to 17 a week or something, if they really had the capacity and time to do that. And a lot of those are obviously influenced by pharmaceutical companies or profit-making organizations. Yours, the foundation, the ELOSA Foundation, is a nonprofit foundation, as I understand it?
Correct, and we take no money from the industry.
And that's so that's important because of...
Either from government or health system.
Go ahead, I'm sorry. Did I lose you?
No, I'm here.
Okay. That's important to be unbiased. I'm thinking this through. The information that your group or the research has come up with is when you say evidence-based, it draws from what's working and what's not working, as well as what some people have run into. It's side effects.
What we do when putting our clinical materials and guidelines together is to search the literature for all of the randomized controlled trials since the last time this particular condition was reviewed and guidelines were developed. So it's all based on trials that were done that are unbiased, that sometimes are blinded studies, so that we actually see and have enough volume of participants in the study so that you can really say the outcomes are validated and generalizable to the entire population. You know, we look at the methodology and is it really a true scientific process? So all of our clinical team are scientific researchers, so they understand the methodology. They actually read all the studies themselves. And we have three clinical advisors that are all Harvard Medical School professors. They practice medicine and they do research with Dr. Avorn and his Division of Pharmacoepidemiology. And so they come together and they discuss all the evidence that's out there and have quite the debate amongst themselves, and then they talk about how does that really, you know, relate to actual practice and the experiences they have as primary care physicians. So it's really quite a process that we go through that's quite academic and unbiased and strong research and science protocols that we come to the assessment of what the best outcomes that we can really relate to the person.
And if you were to describe what the benefits are of academic detailing, what would you say those are?
I would say that it gives information to a doctor in a clinically relevant and interactive way, and so that it's been demonstrated that that type of learning helps people to change their practice behaviors better than giving them a piece of paper that outlines the protocol, or that you go to, let's say, an eight-hour conference on a particular subject matter. They say that people go back and don't actually change their behavior. So the pharmaceutical industry has clearly learned how to influence the behavior of the prescriber to their advantage. So using that same model allows us to influence the practice behavior to an evidence-based approach.
That's great. Well, I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold, and certainly a very interesting subject matter, and appreciate your taking time out of your busy schedule to be one of our guests.
Well, thanks so much, Josh. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about Alosa Health and the great work we do.
Great. Thank you so much. Take care now.
Have a great day.
Yeah, bye-bye.
MSONewsSports.com is your new connection to North Shore News and Sports. We provide video, radio interviews, photos, and much, much more. Our daily North Shore Today post features a local radio newscast, as well as related news stories, photos, and sometimes interesting videos. There are also several ways to listen to our radio programming on the website. On the top left of our webpage is a tab called 24/7 Radio. Here you will find our latest newscasts and interviews. Our MSO Radio Live Channel A tab is a fast way for you to click on and listen to our live programming, talk shows, and live sporting events. We also invite you to follow us on Twitter at MSO News Sports or check out our Facebook page. Very importantly, we want to hear from you. You can email us at msonewsports@gmail.com. That's msonewsports@gmail.com. Or call our voice messaging system at any time, 978-325-3638. That's 978-325-3638.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're thinking of replacing the windows in your home, you should look at the Anderson Woodwright double-hung insert window, which comes with rich wood interiors in oak, pine, or maple. Quite simply, Anderson is the most trusted window in America. That's why we've been selling them for 57 years. Please see the Anderson Woodwright windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
The Gloucester House Restaurant at historic Seven Seas Wharf, 63 Roger Street, Gloucester. This is owner Lenny Linquata.
We provide service and product better than anybody else. It comes directly from our boats right to your plate. We have fishermen that work great for us. We are wholesalers that we buy what we want to serve to our customers, and we put the rest of it right out in the market.
The Gloucester House Restaurant. Visit thegloucesterhouse.com.
This is the freshest seafood you can get from our boats to your plate.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is city councilor, attorney here in Gloucester, Massachusetts, and at-large city councilor, Joseph Orlando, Jr. Joe, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Josh. Appreciate you having me on.
Well, this is kind of a year plus on the job as a city councilor, and I guess I'd ask you to tell us how it's going. Has it met your expectations? And what have you found in the position that's what you expected it to be, and what have you learned that was more than what you had maybe anticipated?
Okay. So, yeah, I'm a year and a couple of months into my first term. So the biggest surprise to me was just learning the procedural rules of every meeting. You know, it's not something I really contemplated all that much ahead of time. I was really much more focused on, oh, you know, how can I affect positive change in Gloucester? You know, what can I do to help on the budget and save people the burden that we put on them? You know, that's really, you know, I was focused more broad scale, you know, things. And you don't really realize when you first take office, the first thing you have to learn how to do is work with each other. You know, everyone seems to be very nice and everyone wants to work together, but how do you do that? The proper procedure, the proper channels to go through, which department heads to talk to about which issues. That's all a learning curve that I had coming in. Sort of didn't really think about it ahead of time, but, you know, I think I'm a quick study, so it didn't really hold me back, which is a good thing. And the city staff has been excellent, really being mentors in different areas. You know, we were able to pick it up pretty quick, but that was sort of unexpected. So if you're asking me what I didn't expect, I certainly did not expect there to be such a big learning curve on procedure and meetings and you know, proper channels. The things that I did expect that I'm ecstatic about are, you know, I really do get the opportunity to help people, my, you know, neighbors, people that I grow up knowing and people I grew up going to school with and playing sports with and what have you. I get to be one of their go-tos for solving some of their problems that maybe plague them every day. So that's a really cool thing, I think. So, I mean, it's really met and exceeded my expectations, really. I love the job. It's a lot of work, more, I think, than I anticipated, but in a good way.
In your estimation, having been on board for a year plus, is this city due for a charter review? And if so, whether it's driven by some time sequence requirement or just time to take another look at what we do and see how we can improve it, any thoughts that you might have developed along the way about changes that might need or be desirable to occur to strengthen the charter that we have?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, it may seem like a radical idea, but one of the things I think needs to be changed is the term of each position in elected city government. Right now, I mean, you have the mayor runs for re-election every 2 years, and you know, as an official like a CEO, you know, 2 years is not a lot of time to get anything done. I mean, you get a lot of, you know, you got to plant a lot of seeds and water them over the course of time to really affect positive change in the future of the city. And 2 years is not a lot of time to do that. You know, I think it would make much more sense for the mayor's term to be 4 years. I think it would make a lot more sense for the city council's term for the same reasons to be at least 3 years. And the other thing I think we could change about the charter is staggering the terms of those councilors so that we don't have all nine running for re-election at the same time or running for, you know, a new seat at the same time. And then you end up like we did last year with five brand new councilors. You know, it might seem like, you know, could seem like a radical concept, but maybe stagger those elections so that you'd have at-large councilors running in 1 year and you'd have, you know, ward councils running in another, and that's a major change. I think the charter could take hold and could really benefit us long term. The problem is, and we're seeing it already, is that we're in year two of a lot of us are in year two of our first term, and you know the Gloucester Times is printing a new article every few weeks about who's declaring they're running for re-election or who's throwing their hat in the ring for the first time, and you know we're just getting started, to be quite honest. So we got a lot of work ahead of us before the end of this term, and I think that, you know, it'd be better for the constituents if, and this is not to say anyone's doing anything wrong, because, look, if you're going to run for re-election, you got to do it. You know, you have to have the support of the constituency to continue your work, which a lot of people have put a lot of hard hours into, so they want to get re-elected, and I respect that. But we're already in the zone now where people are saying, hey, I'm going to run for re-election, and it's only a year and 2 months into the first term.
So, well, you know, your comments are not radical in any sense. Beverly, for example, and Salem, I believe, at least, has a four-year mayoral term. And previously, at least in the city of Gloucester, the terms for school board were staggered, and they were four-year terms as far back as more recently as when I worked in school administration. That was in the last century, but that isn't as long ago as it may sound. Some of the things that have come up on your council shift, obviously you've been involved in the zoning application for permits for medical marijuana. Tell us about that process and any thoughts you have about how that's worked out and so far.
Okay, well, we have a pretty brand new section of the zoning ordinance regarding medical marijuana cultivation facilities and sales facilities. And it was the first time any city council in Gloucester has examined any applications under that, and we had two applications come before us. One we approved and the other one we didn't. So, you know, it was, I actually think the way that the ordinance was written was pretty solid. I think that it was over a course of several years that the previous councils and Mayor Taken and some other people from her staff put a lot of time and effort into writing that ordinance. And they did a pretty good job. It really, you know, it was smoother than I anticipated for the first go around. Go ahead. We'll ask your question.
Why would you? Why only one permit versus two? Is there a reason you'd want to have only one vendor in town, or reason to have more vendors? Help me understand the concept.
I can tell you. I can only tell you the reasons what I voted.
Okay.
And I can't speak for anybody else. One of the applications to me was just a slam dunk. I thought it was, you know, it was a cultivation and sales facility. They were looking to bring 50 jobs to Gloucester, a ton of tax revenue, and a sizable portion of their revenues would be going back to the city. They'd be developing an undeveloped lot. It seemed to me that there's only one section of town these types of facilities can even be located in based on our ordinance, and that's the Blackburn Industrial Park. And even at that, there's limitations because they can't be too close to each other. They can't be too close to schools or churches or any other types of places like that. So, for me, it was one application. The reason I voted yes for it is because it seemed like it was checking all the boxes. And the other application that came in front of us, I would love to have multiple facilities competing with each other. That's better for the consumer. I'm a free market guy, but it just didn't seem like it was good in the safety element. So one of the things we have to worry about with these facilities is safety. There's a lot of theft at these types of facilities, so we did a pretty exhaustive review of that, and I just didn't think the safety element of that second application measured up to what we would need it to be for them to get a permit as well. So I voted no on them. It was good to go through the process to learn what it would take and get public feedback and the like. I think the city is more or less behind it as far as the constituents are concerned. They're more or less behind the concept, and I hope it's a huge success because that's a good thing for Gloucester.
How much is this is really new territory with the passage of the law allowing this to take place. I noticed in your response you talked about a revenue sharing approach that a certain percentage of sales is going to come back into the coffers of Gloucester. Is that unique for Gloucester, or is that something that is standard, to the extent there is a standard, for companies or organizations that are going into business? I mean, if these people were going to Beverly or Danvers, would they necessarily have to be contributing money back, some of their revenue back, or is that the way the law is? Why is that?
I believe, I'm not an expert on this, but I believe that is the deal that was made with the administration of this city.
Okay.
And, you know, it is a host community agreement that has to be signed and a letter of either support or non-opposition or what have you right at the beginning of the process before the applicant can even go over the next steps.
Oh, okay.
And in order to get those letters, there's a negotiation that takes place with the administration. And in this case, anyway, the negotiation involved both facilities that negotiated and got host community agreements negotiated part of their revenues coming back to the city as part of the deal. So I don't know if it's required, but I do know that it's standard.
Great. Now, Fuller School project, Fuller School property, rather, tell us, I know that you're not the driving force. The administration has certainly a certain portion of responsibility here, but give us an update on where that is now and what we can envision seeing in the forthcoming months.
Okay. Well, I mean, I can't speak to my opinion on the merits of the project because it's about to come in front of us, so that would be improper of me.
Okay.
But what I can tell you is where it's at. So the city administration, the mayor's office, has come to a purchase and sale agreement with the Fuller Mixed Use Venture Group, which consists of the YMCA group, Wendover Construction, and the Sam Park group. And the group agreed to, you know, build, they want to build 200 housing units. They want to build a sizable YMCA unit similar to the one in Beverly at the off of exit 18 there. And they also want to include about 25,000 or so square feet of retail space additional to what you already have up there at the Gloucester Crossing area.
Okay.
So that has been agreed to by the administration. Now it has to go through permitting. They have to get a building permit. They have to, I think they're seeking an overlay district, which will be a series of meetings with the planning board and the planning and development subcommittee, conservation commission, and the like, before it comes to the full council for a public hearing and a vote. So there's going to be a series of months of meetings. There's going to be a series of public hearings and a series of votes that have to take place before the project ever happens. But as far as where they are now, they've agreed with the administration in a purchase and sale agreement to purchase the property pending the result of this process.
Okay. And you sit as each of the city councilors in Gloucester sits as a member of a standing committee, although there are several committees and you've delegated out the work and so forth, and then your committee reports back to the full group. And I know you're on the Budget and Finance Committee. Tell us what that's been like. And I know, having read a number of the minutes of meetings, that you folks seem to be accepting a lot of grants for some fairly sizable amounts of money, which means funding that's going to help improve the city but not come from tax revenue from the tax base of property tax and user fees and so forth. Tell us about your experience on the Budget and Finance Committee and anything you can tell us about any of the grants that have come across your committee.
Sure. I mean, I feel like every single Budget and Finance Standing Committee meeting, which is every other Thursday, we're examining whether or not we want to accept grants. I have to say, the city department heads, under the direction of the mayor, have really pushed for grant money from the state, from the federal government, from you know, nonprofits and what have you. And it's a great infusion of cash. You know, you can't always rely on it. There's, you know, sometimes they're one-time infusions and they're not matched. Sometimes you have to match them with your own funds. You know, each one is its own separate animal. But there's, you know, some sizable grant money that's been coming in, which is really a good thing, I think. I think this is money that the state takes from, you know, from various forms of taxes at the state level, and they send it back to the communities in the form of, you know, local aid, they would call it. So, you know, it's good to have, and it's something that comes out of our pockets anyway. At least it comes back to us. It's better that it comes back to us than somebody else, if you ask me.
Sure.
So, you know, for instance, Stage 4 Park, you know, we've been trying to do, the Community Development Department's trying to do a bunch of work over there to, you know, to better the area for various reasons, for, you know, having more events there, to having farmers markets and what have you. And they got a sizable grant. I want to say it was over $300,000 from the federal government to do some of the work over there. And it's, you know, it's Steve Winslow and his group have done a great job putting that together. So, you know, this is one example. I mean, there's community block grants. There's a lot of grants come through the fire department for safety equipment that we need for the firemen. I mean, that's
Tommy
huge.
LeGrande, Captain
you know, we
LeGrande.
We got several hundred thousands of dollars for their safety equipment not long ago for their SCBA masks, and that's a really important program.
Yep.
So I'm glad that happened, too.
Good.
You know, it's otherwise it's coming out of our pockets and the city coffers, and these things are hard to pay for without some help. So
we got about two more minutes before we have to go to our next guest, but anything, any concluding thoughts that you'd like to share, anything that's maybe coming on the table or you may be bringing up that you'd like to share?
Sure, yeah. I just filed a council order, actually, on affordable housing. So we've been hearing for years and years and years how we have a deficiency in affordable housing stock, and that makes us susceptible to a developer just coming in and building it wherever they want without coming in front of the city for any permitting, other than the Zoning Board of Appeals, which is not a good thing for the city because we got no say in the project. So until we reach 10% under that state law, 40B, of affordable housing in the city, we don't have control over that. And an example of that would be the project that the people are trying to put in at Cameron site. It would be an affordable housing project under Section 40B. So my council order speaks to existing stock of housing that's not currently designated affordable but should be within the city, and providing the mechanism for residents to, in a streamlined and inexpensive fashion, get these properties that are otherwise not up to code, so to speak, up to code, get them permitted, get them on the books, get them assessed properly, and designate them affordable. And there's got to be, I would estimate, dozens if not hundreds of those throughout the city. I think it could be a huge boon to our affordable housing stock, and I just filed that council order yesterday.
Great.
So I'm hopeful that we'll be able to go through standing committee and the planning board, and everyone will be on board with the concept. I think it's a good idea.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for being a guest on our program, Trending Now with Josh Arnold. I won't put you on the spot and ask you if you're going to run for re-election, but assuming that you do, we'd like to have you back at a later date and maybe talk about how you're progressing with some of these issues, either whether you run or choose not to run.
Fantastic. I look forward to it.
Thank you, Joe. Take care. Have a good day.
Take care. Bye-bye.
NSONewsSports.com is known for connecting North Shore sports fans with local sports newsmakers. Features on teams and players. Exclusive video interviews following the big games. Live event coverage such as high school football, basketball, hockey, and baseball. Live video coverage of the Gloucester Fiesta. MSO also connects you to the area news leaders. Mayors, state representatives, state senators, town administrators, city and town elected officials, business leaders, and more. Entertainment features. Follow us on Twitter or Facebook at MSO News Sports. Email us at msonewsports@gmail.com. Leave a voice message anytime, 978-325-3638. Stay connected to your North Shore neighbors by simply clicking on msonewsports.com.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. My next guest is Dr. David Driscoll, who is the former Commissioner of Education in Massachusetts. I've met David back in the day when I was a school business administrator and a part of the MASBO Board of Directors, and he was a keynote speaker or at some of our MASBO meetings. And so I want to welcome you to the program, and nice to have you take some time out of your busy schedule to share some stories with us.
Glad to be here.
Now, you were former Commissioner of Education. I know what that is, and I know who you are, but could you start with just tell us your bio, a little bit about your background and so forth?
Yeah, I started out as a teacher, actually, in Somerville, as a mathematics teacher at Weston Junior High School, and then went on to teach high school at mathematics, and then I was an assistant superintendent and superintendent of schools in Melrose, then deputy commissioner for the Commonwealth, and then commissioner. So commissioner is the top CEO, if you will, of the Board of Education in charge of K-12 education throughout the Commonwealth.
And during your time serving at the municipal level and at the state level, education undertook a lot of change. The Education Reform Act of 1993 was passed. Any thoughts about that and what those changes were then and how relevant are they today?
Well, that's interesting that you asked that question. I'm actually writing a book, so that's very fresh on my mind. But I would characterize my time as when I was at the local level. There was a lot of what I call spits and starts, different ways of trying to reform education. It was Chapter 188. There were these sort of one-offs, but nothing really major. And there was a lot of frustration in the state on behalf of people in the field and also political leaders. And then, as you suggest, in 1993, it all came together. I give a lot of people credit. The Republican Governor Bill Weld and Democratic legislature found ways to put the differences aside. It was really all led by a business guy that was just terrific, Jack Rennie. But the Act of 1993 was a pretty remarkable document, and it changed things forever in Massachusetts. It, as Jack liked to say, it was the great bargain. We're going to give you some tools. That included $2 billion in new money over 7 years, by the way, to bring all districts up to foundation. A little bit of the tools, training, and otherwise. But then we're going to hold you accountable. And there are basically three groups that were going to be held accountable. Students, and that turned out to be a test in the 10th grade. They wouldn't get a high school diploma without passing it. Educators, teachers themselves, there was a teacher test that was instituted. And then schools and districts. And there was an accountability system for schools and districts. So it was quite remarkable. Although I don't think, Josh, back in 1993, as optimistic as we were, that anyone would have imagined that come 2005, some 12 years later, that Massachusetts would jump to the front of the country in fourth grade reading, fourth grade math, eighth grade reading, eighth grade math. No state had ever done that. And frankly, we've done it ever since, right up till 2016. And in fact, we read a lot about international tests and how horrible America does and so forth. But if you disaggregate it for states, there's quite a difference in states. When you look at Massachusetts versus these other countries, we do very well. In fact, the latest PISA, we were second to only Singapore in eighth grade science. So it's a tremendous success story, and I don't think in 93 we ever dreamed that we would be that successful.
Wasn't the driving force or one of the driving forces back in 93 or leading up to that, the funding mechanism that we just weren't providing enough support for education?
Yeah, and I might add that I'm a little I'm very concerned myself as really a citizen of Massachusetts that since that time, funding in education has been pretty flat and there's been modest increases and give governors credit and legislators they've done about the best they can in tight years. But the fact is most school districts are experiencing, you know this from being a business manager, most school districts are facing pretty significant increases in things like special education costs, special education transportation, even health insurance, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the state hasn't kept up. So just a note that I'm very worried about today. But going back to 93, I think that, you know, this idea that the great bargain, which was we're going to give you the tools, but we're going to hold you accountable, we stuck with that. And I think on the tools side, no one ever believed that a Republican governor who had run on no new taxes would ever commit the $2 billion over 7 years, but they did. And, you know, subject to annual appropriation, but they came up with the money. They brought everybody up to foundation. So I think that one of the first keys was the fact that people stuck to it, and they stuck to their word, and they stuck to the tools. And that meant a lot in districts, of course, particularly the urban districts that got some money. They had 30 kids in a classroom, you know, at kindergarten level, the buildings falling apart. So that was a key. But I think the other key was the tools that we developed, both the frameworks and eventually the testing and the accountability system and even the teacher testing. All of those things, I think, were done with some care and some input. That's what took so long.
Yep.
It took over a decade. But, you know, we piloted MCAS. We made sure classroom teachers were responsible for reviewing all of the test questions, et cetera. So I think the, and you remember the former Commissioner Antonucci, who was also a local teacher and superintendent. I think the two of us oversaw and managed the system and the new law a little better than most people would. I like to call us safe crackers, for those old enough to remember when safes had dials in the front. You had to turn the tumblers so carefully back and forth. And I think that's something Bob and I did.
You know, go ahead.
Well,
no, go ahead.
No, that's good. That's it. That's
the I filled in. I got a, Mal Patterson called me a few years back and said, hey, we need somebody to do a stint at close out Essex Aggie before they did the merger. And I ended up doing a contract with them to be their business manager. But in the picture ID that I had to wear, because I didn't have to do that a million years ago when I did this stuff, but I got a stethoscope from the nurse's office and had them take a picture of me opening the safe. I thought that was a good picture for a school business guy.
We think alike then.
Yeah, yeah. you know, Massachusetts was the way back when, and Bill Leary was our superintendent at the time, and entered into the school choice realm. And I remember going, riding with Dr. Leary up to see then Senate President William Bulger, and, you know, protesting. Gloucester was one of those communities that got hit hard by school choice because it became a reverse Robin Hood syndrome to a certain extent. Manchester was a neighboring town, had a low capacity of students, so they were letting people in Magnolia and other parts of Gloucester tuition in their kids for $2,500 a year, and suddenly they all got refunds, and we wrote a check for like $6,000 for every child that they had, and everybody in the town got a raise, and all of that. So there was, but school choice, you know, in its present state, is up and working. What depending on how well you, which side of the fence you're on. But it's also becoming more and more a national issue. And it was a national issue before anyway. It isn't something that emanated here. But looking ahead at the current presidential administration, his choice for Secretary of Education, and her background, where do you see things going?
Well, if the administration had their way, and I'm not sure they will, we're going in that direction. And I consider it the tail wagging the dog. And just a comment about Gloucester, and that was probably the worst example of choice and the way it worked out. I mean, it really was all those people of means in Gloucester who sent their kids to Manchester. It wasn't the kids in downtown Gloucester. It was the kids, as you suggest, out in Magnolia, et cetera. So that was really too bad. But that's the price you pay when you adopt these systems. But choice has its place. I mean, I think our charter schools, for example, in Massachusetts did extremely well, have done extremely well. Other states, you know, 18 states that have vouchers. We don't have them in Massachusetts because they're considered unconstitutional. But the new administration is gaga over choice. You know, that's all you hear about, choice, charters, and vouchers. And that's all fine. I mean, I think they have their role. I think they do provide some competition, which is at least in theory a good thing. You know, I don't think Gloucester can compete with Manchester, frankly, so I don't know that that's fair. But I'm for choice. I think it has its place. You don't want kids trapped. It's become refined a little bit whereby it's more focused on kids who are trapped in, if you will, in an urban setting like Detroit or something. And it's a way to give kids some options. My problem is, when I say the tail wagging the dog, it's only 10% of the kids. And at its best, charters and choice aren't going to get more than 15% of the kids, which means 85% of the kids or more are in public schools. And that's 45 million kids, by the way. And those are kids in New York and Los Angeles and Detroit and Memphis and Miami and whatever. And I find it so disheartening to think we're going to ignore the plight of 85% of our kids who are really struggling. Many of them struggling, obviously, financially. The districts are. And put all this money into this alternate approach with the idea that, you know, the marketplace is going to fix it. Well, it's not going to fix it. And somewhere, somehow, we've got to address the regular public schools in America.
Well, and one of the problems that seems to come up when people discuss school choice is that you're in essence saying, well, you can, whether it's a charter school or a choice school, a charter school in particular, don't operate all by the same rules or same guidelines or restrictions that a public school system has, and therefore it's not apples and apples. It's also...
let me interrupt you there. I think that's a good thing. I think the key there is to make sure that charter schools or whatever, let's just stay with charter schools, that charter schools are held to the same accountability system.
Yeah, yeah.
What they do as far as those crazy rules, I think it's great that they don't have those damn rules. I mean, these things about starting school at 8:14 and leaving at 2:32 and all that stuff. I mean, the charter schools, and, you know, I'm very proud of our charter schools, and I visited them often, very proud of our public schools, too. But charter schools get a chance, and think about this, a faculty at Gloucester High School, if they had a chance to push the reset button, say to the superintendent, assistant superintendent, the mayor, the city council, look, we're not going to, all these silly rules we have, we're gonna.
Well, it's up to them to reset the rules they want.
To that extent, I think, but I do think it's very important that they be held to the same accountability. Some people who support charters don't think they should be subject to the same accountability. I completely disagree. They can do whatever they want, and in fact, they might find ways that will help public schools out from under some of this bureaucracy. But they've got to be held to the same rules.
Bill Leary, when he was here, was, of course, he had been in Boston during the desegregation days and then made the tour to New York and then Broward County, and Gloucester was the last stop on the merry-go-round. But he had brought in the Howard Gardner's Frames of Mind program and Sizer's Coalition of Essential Schools. But he had proposed at one point that we modify the foreign language department to include Japanese, Russian, and Arabic. And people laughed at him. I mean, people were just like, we don't need that in Gloucester. And the most vociferous opposition came from the foreign language department. Said, well, the kids don't need that. And so, but you, why I raise that is sometimes the changes, you know, the people inside the system are not as open to change for different reasons as people outside the system are as desiring change for the sake of change, whether it's merit or not.
No, I agree with you. I mean, I think Bill was very forward-thinking in that regard, and I think we sometimes the system. I'm a big defender of the system, but you can't defend all of the rules.
No,
for
no.
example, it's a system whereby we go to school from September to June as if kids still work on farms.
Yeah, all from the agrarian system.
We pay teachers according to how long they've been there, not how good they are. You know, we have all these professional development courses that very rarely have an impact on teaching, and yet we spend millions of dollars. So, you know, there's a lot to fix. But people get comfortable. The parents get comfortable, teachers get comfortable, and it's hard to change. As you suggest, it's very hard as a system. In America, I always joke, this is the joke, if George Washington were to come down on Earth today, because I always use Horace Mann, who was the first commissioner of education. But if George Washington were to come down to Earth today, the only institutions he'd recognize are our schools. And to some extent, that's true.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I often have thought if the founding fathers came back to see what they created, what would they say? But that's a story for another day.
That is exactly right.
We've got about 3 or 4 minutes left. Tell us what do you see? What else do you see going forward? Oh, I'm going to stop it from that. You mentioned in the course of discussion that you're writing a book. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I can. I started out just sort of writing an autobiography. I wanted to kind of get things down You know, I worked for John Silver. There were some interesting times. You remember all that. So
yeah.
I wanted to get it recorded. I wanted to record some of it. I've heard so many people talk about why Massachusetts is successful. They give this reason and that reason, and they're usually only partially right. So I thought I had a very interesting perspective, of course, having come up through the ranks and being a deputy commissioner. So that's what I'm writing. But I also include in there, which I think is what your question gets to, I also include in there at the end my vision of the future. First of all, I talk about the things that schools in other states could do. Now, a lot of people say, well, you're Massachusetts, you've got all these advantages. To some extent, that's true, but we weren't in the top 10 sometimes, so we did something right.
Yeah.
I think other states could learn a lot of things. One of which is this idea of putting aside differences. Jack Rennie used to say, everybody in the boat, and we're all going to drink a little castor oil. So our law, much to the chagrin of the unions, did have choice and charter, but it also had the foundation budget. There was a little bit for everybody, but there were things. So I think other states need to get out of their comfort zone and stop mandating things from on high and do what we do, which is set pretty reasonable but high expectations. And then stick with it, and then give the tools to the teachers, to the kids, to schools, to get the job done. And we're not doing that. I mean, it's the legislators that pronounce from on high, kid can't go to the fourth grade unless they pass the third grade reading test. Well, that's all well and good, except if you're in a school and dealing with these kids. And the kid is, you know, in a household that's got trauma and other issues and, you know, what are you going to do? Just hold the kid back? I mean, so I think as I look to the future, I think there's a lot to be learned from Massachusetts. Now, you know, other states are different. They can do things in different ways. I'm very impressed with the way Tennessee is proceeding right now. They've really done a tremendous job. But it takes everybody coming together, putting aside some differences. You know, we live, as you know, in a very polarized world. It's a blue state, it's a red state, and really schools are having difficulty coping with students who are coming from families that are just polarized.
Yeah.
And so I think as I look to the future, I would hope that schools and states would learn from Massachusetts, figure out how to settle differences for the sake of kids, come up with some common sense logic about standards and set them well and then stick to them and focus on that and stay with it. That's what we did. And I'm afraid, although the new law gives authority back to states, that I see very little evidence that states, that many states are taking kind of the longer view, which I think they should.
Well, thank you. You know, you mentioned the unions, and I have to tell you, when you're in the arena and you're going through your day to day, you make mental notes of things. And my first week or two on the job, when I was a business manager, they call it something else, a director of operations in Gloucester, and you know, the president of the teachers union pulled into the administrative parking lot in a Cadillac. And there were two bumper stickers on the car. One said, "Beam me up, Scotty," and the other said, "I don't get mad, I get even." And I just, and I was like, who the hell is that? That's the president of the teachers union. And it just hit me, and it's, you know, it's just no relevance really, but it's one of those things that you make a mental note of. And if I ever wrote a book about an anecdotal approach, that's, I'm sure that would be in there. But I mean, I'll be anxious to see your book and see what you have in there.
One last thing, Josh. I know we're running out of time, but one I include in my book some what I call Driscoll truisms, and one of them is cut things in half and cut things in half again. And when I go across the country, I do some stuff now, and I've been involved nationally on some boards. You know, this issue, the unions, is a perfect issue. I mean, it's a divisive issue. If you talk to someone, they either love the unions or they hate the unions. And I remember, we had a superintendent of schools, Ed Tynan, who was a great guy down in Barnstable. And he used to say, "I love my teachers, I hate my union members." And of course, they're one and the same. So it's easy to bash unions. You know, sometimes they do put adults' interests before kids and so forth. But on the other hand, you know, who's going to fight for the teachers? And, you know, I can't even tell you how many, leaders, one sort of another, political leaders that say we've got to increase teacher salaries. Well, they never do.
Dick,
so the unions have their role.
No, I know that. Dick Lamb.
And I think that's one of the lessons we learned. Jack Lenny. Everybody's got to drink a little castor oil. The unions had to swallow some things, but they had to be held accountable. I mean, they fought MCAS, even though they liked the law because it gave them money, but they didn't like MCAS. But that was part of the deal. So I think we've got to. I understand your anecdotal story, but I do think we've got to get away from this polarization of we versus them, or else we're just not going to be successful.
Dick Lamb was the mayor of North Adams when I was in college there at North Adams State, now Mass College of Liberal Arts, and I worked as an assistant to the mayor, and he told me good faith bargaining doesn't begin and end at the table. It's something you do in practice every day. It's not just, this is what we negotiated, and that stuck with me. I've always carried that, and I always had good relations with the unions because of that approach. I was more interested in understanding what the problem was as opposed to what the grievance was. So,
yeah.
But whatever that's
worth. And there are some optimistic approaches now with the with the issues bargaining and not the old finding ways to come together and that
getting
kind of
to year stuff. Yeah.
So,
well, I want to thank you for being a guest. I wish you well with your consulting and the new book. You'll have to let me know when that's out.
Will do. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you, David. Bye.
Well, that was informative.
Yeah, it was a good good show.
Yeah, very nice. I didn't know what Alosa, is that what it was?
Yeah,
I didn't know
yeah.
Mr. Driscoll, whom I've had some communication with over the years.
Yeah, I'm sure. You did very well not to say anything. I kept looking over and saying, there's an MCAS question coming here, I know it.
Well, with age comes wisdom, you know. So there you go. What's on some future shows we got planned here?
Mark Whitmore, the executive director of North Shore Career Center, is scheduled for March 24th. We have Martha Wood, project manager at the Gloucester Arts and Cultural Initiative, will be with us that day as well. Joanne Simon, the executive director of Northeast ARC, will be with us on March 31st. As will Megan Gormley, who's the volunteer service manager for the U.S. Seniors Open, coming up in June and July in Peabody at the Salem Country Club.
Excellent. All right, thank you, sir. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
So happy St. Patrick's Day to you.
And happy St. Patrick's Day to everybody. This is MSO News Sports. On behalf of Josh Arnold, I'm Rick Moore. On behalf of our producer and engineer, Bill Proposky as well, have a great day.